Blog Talk Radio.
He was Florida's my home, and I know I'll never ever want to roam, 'cause the ladies are lovely and drinking is considered a sport. And I'd rather be here just drinking a beer than be freezing my ass in the north. The other day I was out on the water, something kind of magical out there. I was fooling around with this old man's daughter, drinking more than my share of his beer. Well, they paid me to play, and then they asked me to stay and help them finish what was left of their booze. Hell, I could be anywhere, but I think I'll just stay here. This old island is the life I choose. Key West, Florida is my home, and I know I'll never ever want to roam, 'cause the ladies are lovely and drinking is considered a sport. Rather be here just drinking a beer than be busting my ass in New York. So I'm swimming every day out in my ocean. At night I'm just hanging out in this bar. I got fresh fish to eat, and whenever I need, I got genuine Cuban cigars. And my ex-wife thinks I'm crazy. Called me long distance to tell me I'm being weird. While she's freezing her butt off, I'm wearing cutoffs. And bartender, I think I need another beer. Key West, Florida is my home. I know I'll never ever want to roam, 'cause the ladies are lovely and drinking's my favorite sport. Well, second. I'd rather be here just drinking a beer than freezing my ass in the north. And I'd rather be here just drinking a beer than be freezing my ass in the north.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Keeping It Real with Cindy. We have a really special guest today. It's a singer-songwriter that has been playing in the Keys for more than 30 years. He pulls so many people here, you know, just like my husband and I, and most of you know both Wayne and I. And you know, as soon as we would come down on vacation, we would make a beeline for Schooner Wharf, which is where Michael plays. I'm going to bring him on air because that's the reason why we have him on the show today, is to hear from him. Michael, are you there?
Uh-huh.
Hey.
Right here.
That song that we just did was the Conk Republic song that was written by Michael.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What was that?
And I think it's, you know, you have so many favorites of ours, but of so many people. And I do have a real quick short story I wanted to tell you. Because a girlfriend of mine came down and visited since we've moved here, and I brought her down to see you, and she got hooked, just like everybody does. And she went back to St. Louis with her CD and got in her car and put the convertible down, and she's driving down the road, and she gets to a stoplight, and the guy in the car next to her screams out, "Is that Michael?" And so you're known everywhere.
By accident.
And she said, she just thought it was hilarious. She had to call me. She said, it was a younger man in the car. And
yeah.
And he knew who you were.
Yeah.
But it doesn't surprise me at all.
It was funny, as I was listening to that, I was reminded of the how and when of when that song was actually recorded the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a strange situation. I had always done my recording in recording studios, but most of the time they wouldn't let me record because I had this bad habit of showing up drunk. And so, you know, being the efficient drunk that I am, I decided, well, I'll fake them all out and I'll just build my own studio. So I made my own digital studio in my house. And I recorded the song. And I went back and listened to it the next day when I was really drunk when I recorded it. And I went back and listened to it the next day when I was sober. My initial thought was, oh, God, that's so sloppy. That's so bad. I mean, that guy is really, really bad. And then I went, hold it. What's this song about? And then I realized, I think I'll just leave it the way it is. It's loose. It's got lots of weird dangling ends hanging in it. It's just, you know, it's a bad recording. And it sounds like the product of a drunk. And I decided that for believability's sake, we'll just leave it the way it is.
Yeah. And you know, everybody loves it. But, you know, there's so many songs that you have that everybody's crazy about. But I got to ask you, because I don't know, how long have you been playing at Schooner Wharf in Key West? Or how long have you been playing in Key West and then Schooner?
In Key West, it's over 40 years, but I choose not to keep track.
Okay.
The funny thing about the passage of time, if you can vividly remember how long it's been since something happened or since something started, then it's also a gentle reminder of how long you've been at it and how old you're getting. And so to keep my mind from believing that I'm really the age that I am, I just choose not to dwell on it. You know, it's like I see every moment of my life as a moment in time, but not necessarily a passage of time, just a moment. The great example of that is back a few years ago, well, 3 years ago, during spring break. I think I told you this story.
Mm-hmm.
And
go ahead.
You know, the town was overrun by, you know, post-adolescent nubiles experiencing the rut for the first time. And there was this 6-foot-tall woman with curly auburn hair and blue eyes standing right next to the stairway, next to the stage. And she's looking at me with this smile on her face, and I'm trying to think of some nice way of telling her that I'm now a happily married man. At which point she comes up to the front of the stage, and she's wearing this bikini with you know, no butt in it. And she looks at me and she says, "Hi, Granddaddy."
Oh, my God.
The last time I had seen her, she was 9 years old. So that was the moment that I captured in my life, was the 9-year old. And then here we are, you know, 12 years later, and this full grown woman walks up to me in a bikini that's, you know, barely on and says, "Hi, Granddaddy." Yeah. That's what I mean.
Yeah. And I know, but you know, it's kind of not unusual to have that in Key West either. The description of what you just gave, which, you know, brings me to the reason why you moved here and stay here.
Key West. It's a very simple story. I used to live in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Mm-hmm. There were two things I didn't like about Virginia Beach. Number one was that thing they do every year called winter.
Yes.
And the last winter that I spent in Virginia Beach, the ocean and the inlet actually froze. I mean, there were icebergs floating near the beach. I mean, it was ridiculous. And so I knew I wanted to leave. And the other thing I didn't like about Virginia Beach was, through the passage of time, Chesapeake, Virginia, which is right next to Virginia Beach, became the center of the Christian Broadcasting Network. I have nothing against them, except for the fact that they have a whole lot against bars.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly but surely, they pooled their money together and they turned almost every bar in Virginia Beach into a saltwater taffy shop.
No.
Now, it's real hard for guys like me to make a living in the saltwater taffy shop.
Exactly.
So one night in the middle of February, I think it was, some young lady, this good-looking little blonde lady, walked into the place where I was playing, the Holiday Inn of all things. I think I was playing for six people in the room. She walked in and she said, "I play flute with the band that's down the street at the Jewish Mother. Can I sit in with you on the next set?" And I said, "You can sit in with me right now." And she sat in, and it was funny because the strange thing about music and musicians is, you know, if you're going to get along with someone, not necessarily by the conversation that happens, but by how well you interpret what the other person is doing musically.
Mm-hmm.
There's this give and take, this byplay that happens between musicians on stage, especially the first time they've ever played together.
Mm-hmm.
And this girl knew exactly where I was going and exactly what I was getting ready to do and exactly when I was going to change it and exactly what I was singing, sang harmonies perfectly. I mean, it was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So later on that night, I went down to the Jewish Mother where she was playing, and I sat and listened to her and her band, who all happened to be the Survivors, you know, the old Key West band.
Right.
Jen and Woody Allen and all the guys were her band, and they had made this trip up to Virginia Beach to play with her. And afterwards, we sat around talking about Key West and stuff, and these guys kept saying, "Dude, you got to come down to Key West. I mean, really." She told me, "You know, you're a good songwriter and a good guitar player and a good singer. You got to come down to Key West." And about that moment, I yawned.
Mm-hmm.
At which point she says, "Oh, you poor thing, it's getting late, isn't it?" At which point, Ben Allen, who was her bass player, who still lives in Key West, looked at me and he said, "Mm-hmm. You know, if you played in Key West, you could play during the daytime."
Mm-hmm.
And I went, "Come on." He said, "No, really." He said, "There's four or five places in town that have live music during the daytime." I said, "You got to be kidding me." He said, no, they really do." Well, she and I spent the next two or three days together, and we had a wonderful time, and I think I almost fell in love. And then she left town, and the weather got worse, and one thing led to another, and I decided, oh, to hell with it. I'm just going to Key West. And I packed up my five-year-old son and the belongings we needed for tropical weather, and we headed on down to Key West, and we haven't left yet.
And you've been here ever since. And so, yeah, it's the same thing that brought you here that probably keeps you here, right?
You mean
the
good-looking women? You mean good-looking women?
The good-looking women, right. And the alcohol,
like,
of course.
I like living
and you can
in
drink
a place.
Day.
Yeah, I like living in a place where women can walk around half naked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the bikini bathing suits that they sell these days are nothing more than, you know, fancy underwear.
Right.
And for a guy like me, you know, I mean, I'm no longer involved in the great game of life. I mean, you know, I'm at that age where it's probably best to retire that particular part of my life. But I still enjoy watching. I still enjoy looking. And God, it is really, honest to God, a wonderful thing to be playing mm-hmm. for people who, first of all, they have this look on their face like, "We're going to have us a good time, God damn it." So
mm-hmm.
nobody's bringing an attitude. Well, very rarely. And secondly, there's all these beautiful, beautiful women out there. And you just get to sit there and watch them and just think to yourself, God, I wonder what the poor people are doing today.
Yes. That's something my sister says all the time when we come down to see you. And she'll sit and use exactly those words.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So, now that you've told us how you got here, and I know you just said you don't like going back, but can you tell me what got you started in music, you know, your biggest inspiration to become an artist?
It was instinctual. My father was a piano player and a singer and an actor who had a big enough ego to be able to pull it off on stage, but a small enough ego not to be a megalomaniac.
Mm-hmm.
There's a fine line there. And most guys who do it on stage have long since gone over that line. But he was this wonderful man, and he picked it up from his mother. His mother was a Welsh lady who played piano and sang constantly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she sang constantly, and she had this beautiful upper alto soprano voice. And so until I was I got a little over 2 years old, my parents lived in my grandmother's house.
Mm-hmm.
My earliest recollection in my life is sitting on my grandmother's knee right in front of the Victrola, playing 78 RPMs of Peter and the Wolf, this classical piece, a Russian classical piece, where every instrument represented a different character in the story. So when when you're 2 years old and you know that the duck is the clarinet.
Yes. You learned really, really early.
Right. Yeah, so you hear the clarinet. Now, oddly enough, the clarinet and the soprano saxophone have the very same range. They can play the very same notes. They have slightly different sounds. So I'm a three-year-old who can tell the difference between the sound of a clarinet and a soprano saxophone. I can tell the difference between a bassoon and an oboe. I can tell the difference between a French horn and a trumpet. I can tell and it's strange because this stuff was planted in my head by these people who were my parents and my grandparents. So as I grew up, the most important thing they gave me was the ability to listen, to be able to hear succinctly what is good or bad or indifferent. Because if you can tell the difference between those things, you can play music.
Yeah.
You can tell when
you have. You have your grandmother's. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Excuse me?
I said you can tell
when a note is slightly flat or slightly sharp, or whether the beat is slightly off or whatever. It's so hearing is the most important thing. And luckily, here as I approach 70, I still have really good hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thankful for that.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to say, you did get your grandmother's genes because you have a beautiful voice. There are some songs that you know that I love you to play, and your voice is just amazing.
Well, that comes from them, and something my grandmother used to say. She said, the human larynx is simply a muscle. That's all it is. If you use it, it gets stronger. If you don't, it gets weaker. And then she looked at me and she said, the same is true for the brain, by the way.
And that is true. And, it's really strange because my mother and father were divorced when I was really young, like three. But my best memories of being around my dad early, when I was young, we would sit on the floor in front of him and he would play the guitar and sing to us. And there was always a particular song that stuck with me even all through these years. And he's gone now, but he used to sing us the song Sunny by Bobby Hebb. Do you remember that song? It's kind of old.
I used to play that song.
Yeah, he used to sing that to us. And so I kind of relate to your story in the sense of being around the music since you were little. Probably why I love music so much now.
Yeah.
And also as I grew up, and this was going to be a question for you too, because as I grew up, I hung with these kids that played music in their garages and basements and things like that, that now are playing in the bars in St. Louis. And so, I was with them when they were just garage bands. Did you have a garage band or a basement band when you first started as a kid?
No, what I had was a brother.
Okay.
I had a brother. And we had the Nashville sibling rivalry going. He was only a year and a half younger than me. And so we had one guitar in the house. Mm-hmm. Because there was one guitar in the house, this is my dad's doing. He knew what he was doing. He could have got two guitars, but he decided on one because he knew that if either one of us started making headway on the guitar, that would prompt the other one to steal those licks.
Mm-hmm.
And so over what happened is we ended up with this fast track of learning to play the guitar. In less than a year, both my brother and I were playing professionally. Now, granted, I was 13 and he was 12, but
mm-hmm.
we were playing for the Lions Club and the Women's Club and the Garden Club. And whenever they had a meeting and they wanted some live entertainment, we'd play three or four songs. It was all, folk music, because that was the thing at the time. And this guy, my brother, had the same ears that I've got, so that he could sing harmony to anything that I sang, and I could sing harmony to anything that he sang. And we both were sticklers about how we played the guitar and stuff. So at first, I guess probably when we first started doing it, we only had one guitar. We saved up our money and we got two guitars. And one of us would play a high-tuned version of the song and the other one would play a low-tuned version of the song. So we had separate notes that we were playing and it all blended together. And we both knew that this was what we were supposed to do. And this went on until I graduated from high school, and I had a brief experience attempting to go to college, but there was way too much extracurricular activity going on. So I joined the Navy. During the time I was in the Navy, I ended up being in a band. And when I got out of the Navy after Vietnam, I just naturally fell into playing music for a living because I knew that's what I was going to do. Coincidentally, at that same time, my little brother married his high school sweetheart, and she told him, "You're not going to play music anywhere but in church, and that's the way it's going to be for the rest of your life."
Oh, my gosh, okay.
And so now he plays music in church, and he works at
mm-hmm.
Walmart, and I hate to say it, but the poor boy is pretty miserable.
Yeah.
Pretty miserable.
I would imagine. So he's still playing in churches and working at Walmart while you're in Key West. That's a little surprising, I guess, that competitiveness kind of left after a while. Or
well,
he got married.
That's what we do for love, you know? I mean, we're crazy people when it comes to love. You know?
Mm-hmm.
We do stupid
yes.
stuff.
We do. We do. So of all of the songs that you've written, is there one that moves you every time you sing it?
Yeah. It's called "They Don't Make 'Em Like." It's called "They Don't Make 'Em Like You Anymore." It's a song that I wrote for my wife, Rose. I know, probably 20 years ago. It was one of our anniversaries, and somebody had planned a kind of a special little party for us, and so there were people coming over to the house and stuff, and I was actually listening to a Jim Croce album, I don't know, a couple of days before the party, and I heard this song that he was playing. I can't remember the name of it, but it had a really nice chord progression, and the guitar part was really nice, so I figured out what the chords were, and then I played them in reverse order. And when I played them in reverse order, all of a sudden the chords told me what the melody line was, and I started whistling the melody line. As soon as I got the melody line memorized in my head, then the melody line told me what the song was about, and the concept of what the song was about told me what the words were. And by the time I was done, and then an hour and a half later, I had this anniversary song for my wife, and it's kind of an old people's love song,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And it is, you know, and that's one of our favorites. Actually, Wayne will get up on the dance floor with me for our anniversary every time we come to Schooner Wharf, which we've been doing for years and years before we moved here, and we would ask you to play that song on our anniversary. Yeah. And we didn't care if anybody was up, we were going to be up dancing.
I'll tell you something strange about that song. I don't have any trouble playing it, so long as my wife is not in the room.
Really?
Yeah, but if my wife is in the room, and even if I don't look at her, if she's there, about the middle of the first chorus, my voice starts cracking, and I get choked up.
Yeah.
She's the best part of my life. I mean, she really is. She's the very best part of my life. She's everything I could ever have asked for in a mate for life. And she's smart and funny and good-looking and energetic and interesting and creative and inventive. And she's just a wonderful person. I really love my wife.
Yeah. And she does all of your website and work and all of that too, doesn't she? And I should bring that up.
Huh?
Go ahead. I said, go ahead.
I'm losing you. Can you speak up?
Oh, I'm sorry. I said, go ahead. I was just going to bring up your website address for everybody.
She's a very busy person. She's one of those people who believes that as long as you keep your brain busy, it won't fail you.
Mm-hmm.
And so she keeps her brain very, very busy. She's always working on something. She's a great artist. I mean, just a great artist. She's got a portfolio of probably 250 ocean-themed Christmas cards.
Oh, my gosh.
And they are absolutely just beautiful. Every year she comes up with a new one, but she's in her spare time, in the middle of August, she's got a few moments. She'll sit down and take what appears to be a piece of coral with fish around it and turn it into something like an underwater Christmas tree.
Oh my gosh.
I mean,
very creative.
Yeah, she's really cool.
Does she sell her Christmas cards or does she just use them for herself? Okay.
No, she's a lot like I am in the sense that I do a lot of building too. I keep my brain busy by building things and making things. And I found that I make pretty good furniture, very functional, nice looking furniture. The problem with it is if I sell it, it loses its value to me. Whereas if I give it away, it doesn't.
And I get that because, Wayne and I do that too.
Mm-hmm.
And we build. And it does lose value. And we had so many people come to us after we built the bar that I showed you the plans for.
Yeah.
Asking us to do the same. And it's like, no. Yeah, so I really do understand why it kind of keeps its value.
It's like I do a lot of work on guitars, I know what the value of a certain job is when it comes to, making a piece of furniture or working on a guitar or whatever it is. And so I always try to give somebody a break in the price because, I'm at that wonderful point where I don't need the money now.
Mm-hmm.
But inevitably, as soon as money becomes an issue, even if it's half the price of what they expected it to be, they look at you with this quizzical look and say, that much, huh? And you go, hold it. Why don't I just eliminate this whole roadblock and just give you the piece? And now you get to feel guilty instead of me getting to feel guilty.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Yeah. And it works out really, really well. I like the way it works because the only reason I do any of these things is to keep myself busy and just to keep my brain working and keep my hands functioning correctly and stuff. And so I'm actually doing myself a favor by doing the work or building the piece or whatever it is. So I've already achieved my profit emotionally and intellectually. So why not just give it away?
Yeah. And I have seen some of your pieces, and they're really awesome. I mean, I think
yeah,
you made a table. Yeah, that table that you made that was shaped differently, I thought was beautiful. But I wanted to ask you too, just personally for me, do you take old guitars and just fix them up if someone was to give them to you, or you don't do that? I mean, as a gift.
I did for years. One of my, when I was learning to work on guitars, one of the things that I did was whenever I got, $100, $150 together that I didn't, that wasn't budgeted, pure profit, I would go to a pawn shop and I would purchase a piece of junk, a guitar that just was a piece of junk. And I would turn it into something that not only could be played and played well, but something that a working musician would appreciate. And that's how I learned the craft of luthiery, as they call it. And over the years, I've picked up a whole lot of, tricks and stuff and how to get it done. Plus, I've, come up with a few inventions of my own that solve some problems that are inherent in guitars. And it's always been there. It's more of that same thing that if you're getting paid to do something you love, then you just can't get enough of going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so to this day, if I see something in a pawn shop that looks like it can be resurrected and turned back into a player's guitar, I'll buy it. I'll fix it up. I'll make it work. I'll put the electronics in it that are necessary to make it a player's guitar, a professional player's guitar. And then I'll give it away. And, then, of course, inevitably it breaks my heart because, 6 months, a year, year and a half later, I'm in a pawn shop or a music store and I see the guitar that I gave away to somebody and I go, I thought you said you wanted that. But then again, people get into financial problems. They have to do what they have to do. But I still do it. I don't try to turn anything into a piece of art. I just try to clean them up and make them work better. And I don't like kitsch art. I don't see the point in creating baubles.
Right.
Which,
you just told us something that nobody knew, don't you?
What's that?
So you told us these things that you do that are so kind, fixing these guitars for people that might otherwise not have them.
I'm doing it for me. I'm not doing it for them. Once the job is done and I've received all of the intellectual and emotional gratification that I can out of doing the job, at that point, the value of the guitar is gone because there's nothing more I can do to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing more I can do to it, then since it has no value for me, I may as well just give it away.
Yeah.
It makes more sense.
Go ahead. Yeah. And amazing to me that, here you are, a very well-known artist here in Key West, that you balance your life through doing these things, not only your life, but as you said, you keep your brain working, your hands working, and it balances you as a person to be go ahead.
That's because of my dad. See, my dad was, he was the great philosopher, If there's anything about me that has any intrinsic or lasting value, it's everything I stolen from my dad. And all of that is intellectual. He was the smartest, funniest man I ever met in my entire life. And he was great. He could teach me anything in 15 minutes to a half an hour. It didn't matter how complicated it was. It didn't matter how strange it was. Anything else, he could get me started and create an interest so that I could continue learning about it. And I asked him one day, why is it so easy for you to teach me and so hard for those people at school to teach me? And he looked at me and he said, well, I guess it has to do with wit. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, three species on the face of the earth that can laugh. And I said, what are those, Dad? And he said, well, there's the West African bonobo chimpanzee, the one with no hair on its front. There's mm-hmm. the Atlantic porpoise. But the problem with those is the only way they'll laugh is if you tickle them. He said, human beings are the only animal on the face of the earth that can laugh at an intellectual concept. And if they're lucky, they can laugh at themselves.
Right. And you know, in one of your CDs, Another Day
yeah.
in Paradox, you have a
yeah.
write-up about your dad.
Yeah.
And so, by the way, everybody, I want you to, if you want to get Michael's stuff, it's michaelmcleodmusic.com, but you can also download his music on cdbaby.com.
And on
iTunes, too. Sorry about that, Michael.
Yeah.
And I think it's time for everybody to hear another one of your songs. So what do you say we take a little break?
All right.
Okay. So we're going to play my husband's favorite, one of his favorites. There's many, but my husband's favorite is a song called Peace and Quiet. So here's Michael McLeod with Peace and Quiet.
A little song about getting old. It's called Peace and Quiet. I need some place that doesn't have winter. Someplace I can stay warm, where this old man can fish whenever he wish, except for that occasional storm. Now they say I'm getting older and wiser. Well, God knows I should have by now. I think I know what I need from this life that I'm leading. I sure hope to have it somehow. I'm just looking for some peace and quiet. Someplace I could let myself be. Ain't bothering no one, don't want bothering. Nobody's bothering me. I'll take some place that doesn't have winter, and I get paid for what I should do for free. Going to howl at the moon, I'm going to get up at noon. I don't think retirement is for me. They say middle-aged madness is dangerous, but hell, you just gotta know what you need. Need my place in the sun until my days are all done, and that'll work out just fine for me. I'm just looking for some peace and quiet, someplace I can let myself be. I ain't bothering no one and don't want bothering. Nobody's bothering. I'll take some place that doesn't have winter, where the ocean is a part of my life, and this woman who needs to be needed by me, being my best friend and my wife. And old age will come over me slowly, then it'll be a day-to-day grind. Gonna be living with less, all but nevertheless, I'm gonna have me one hell of a time. And I ain't looking for no fame or fortune. I know that ain't the kind of life for me. I ain't bothering no one that don't want bothering. Nobody's bothering. I'm just looking for some peace and quiet. A
maybe someplace down here in the Keys. I ain't bothering no one and don't want bothering. Nobody's bothering me. Ain't nobody bothering me. I need some place that doesn't have winter.
Thank you much. Thanks. Sure. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And that, my friends, is one of my husband's favorites of many. But so, Michael, you know, I also wanted to bring up the fact that your songs are have been on the, and correct me if I'm wrong, the History Channel and Sirius XM Radio.
Yeah, they supposedly I'm on XM Radio. I don't have XM Radio, so I don't know. But people come in and tell me that I'm on the Coffee House, and I'm on New Country, and I'm on whatever, Wild Country or something like that. I'm on a jazz channel. And I don't. So far, I've counted 10 different channels that they say I'm on, but I haven't heard any of it. I have this. When I was very, very young, I wrote a commercial for a car dealership in Beckley, West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
It was 30 seconds long. And it was my first recorded attempt at anything, and it actually came out pretty neatly. Problem was, I had my radio on a couple days later, and I heard it on the radio. Mm-hmm. And I went, oh, God. And it was like in my mind I could only see him as a different entity from me. And I'm not sure whether that was a fail-safe mechanism that I built into my psyche or what, but I can't listen to me playing music.
Oh. You know, I can't listen to my shows again once I've had them. I don't go back and listen.
I had a really strange experience back a few years ago. When I was in high school, I wrote a couple of articles for a magazine in the state of West Virginia, travel like magazine. And I thought I was a pretty good writer.
Mm-hmm.
And back, I don't know, 20 years ago, before my mother and father died, for one reason or another, they decided, it was when they were selling their house. They decided to sell their house in West Virginia, and they went through the attic, and they saved things that they thought the boys might want to keep. And they brought me this thing that was intended, this box, that was intended to become a scrapbook, but my mother never got around to it. And it was, newspaper clippings and stuff like that, and then there were these two copies of this magazine, two different copies of a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the article, and I was absolutely astonished at how incredibly stupid I was. That is the reason why I will never write anything in the form of prose. If I write at all, it will be in the form of a song. It will be short and sweet and only hit the high spots, and there will be nothing else in there, because the songs that are on, that you just played the live recording, all the songs on the live recording were originally recorded on my first two CDs, but because I got smarter over the years, or at least I think I did, the songs got longer, and so the new verses on the live CDs with the new verses and new choruses added to them, and the older versions on the early CDs, but and so for that reason, I assume that everything I write is not really finished. That I have a moment of inspiration somewhere along the way in the future that's going to wrap that song up, and I'll just add one more verse to it and one more chorus, and the song will finally be finished.
Right. And you've done that, too. You've added verses, too. And, you know, it's funny because – so many people that are just here visiting that are listening to you have no idea. But us that have heard you for years and years, we, you know, suddenly we stop and we're like, that's not the same. And so, you know, I find it really interesting when I hear you do a song that you've added a new verse to. And it's usually for a good reason. We like it.
Yeah.
And sorry about that. We have all of your CDs, but if you want me to tell the honest truth, my husband last night late, I said, honey, you need to upload some more music to my radio show. So he did it really quickly for me. And I didn't know which ones he uploaded from, you know, as far as which CDs. And he's my tech guy. I'm not a horribly technical person. I like my hands dirty. And so I don't spend a lot of time doing technical things. And he's a computer person. So I just tell him, honey, I want this, and he does it. So,
my father once said a great relationship consists of two people that have one pretty good mind between them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and he's right. He's right. That's mm-hmm. what it comes down to. It's a team. You know, that a relationship is a team. And between
right.
the two of you, if the two of you put together have one really good mind, then you have a functioning intellect. You know,
oh, yeah.
There's a whole bunch of things that my wife knows everything about that I know nothing about. She was a nurse for a long time. So when, you know, when we're watching a television show about a doctor, you know, she, and they veer off the script and they say something, you know, technical, she'll go, bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And it really,
yeah.
She said, yeah, it doesn't work that way. You know, and she doesn't know that's not how it's done, you know.
Right. And yeah, you have your part that you add to her to make you,
yeah.
you know, that individual that is connected to
yeah.
forever connected. And that's
yeah.
how I kind of feel about my husband too, because we both have our specialties and it just works. We can, you know, if we're building something, if I can't help, I know what he needs before he needs it. So I have
yeah.
it ready, and
yeah.
it's almost like one mind working. It's kind of funny to watch when we're working on a project together. And so, yeah. But, okay, let's go on to talking about Michael again. So, you know, I know you have not collaborated very much, but you have collaborated with one person. Can you talk about that a little?
Michelle Silverstein?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that all
did.
Came about. That's another real funny stories. When I first got down here, one of my original jobs was working Sunset at the Casa Marina.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, Shel Silverstein walks in, and he's got like Miss April from 1979 or whatever on his arm, and. And he walks up to me, and he has this horrible speaking voice and singing voice. It's a cross between fingernails on a blackboard and a cat fight. And he says to me, he says, you got a pretty nice singing voice there, bud. I said, well, thank you very much. And he says, I don't suppose you do demos, do you? And I went, yeah, I can do demos. And he said, I play real well. I said, all right, that'd be fine. He said, you here every day? I said, I'm here every day. And he said, all right. He said, I'm going to bring you some cassette tapes tomorrow. I want you to listen to the songs. I'll see what you can make out of them. I said, oh, okay, fine. And then he turned around and walked away. And I'm going, you know, I've seen the face before, but I couldn't place it. And this little waitress comes up, and she said, you know who that was? You know who that was? I said, who was it? She said, that's Shel Silverstein. And I said, oh, you mean the guy from Playboy magazine? And she looked at me like I was talking out of my navel or something. And she said, no, the guy who wrote the children's books. Possibly be the same person? So when I got home, I did a little investigation. I found out that Shel Silverstein, who was one of the co-founders of Playboy magazine back in the ancient old days,
a guy who lived at the Playboy Mansion in Chicago for 18 years, was also the best-selling children's author in America with 6 different books that he had released, which had become part of the school curriculum in various places. And I'm going, oh, my God, who did I meet here? And so the next day he brings me the cassette tapes, and I'm all apologetic, like, you know, I should have known who you are. And he says, why? I said, well, I mean, you're Shel Silverstein. He says, yeah, I know, so what? And he was just this really easygoing, down-to-earth guy. So I listened to the songs, and he said, you know, we'll meet it on following Wednesday or whatever it was at Privateer Studios. And so I showed up at Privateer Studios, and the first thing I said was, okay, I listened to the songs. I said, the structure of the songs is great. Good chords, good melody line, good words. I said, but the presentation sucks. He says, well, what did you expect? I only know 5 guitar chords, and this is my only voice. And I said, okay. Do what you can with them. And then, all right. So we recorded one of the songs. And his ears perked up, and he looked at me through the glass, and he goes, oh, my God. Oh, my God. He comes running into the room when I'm finished with the song, and he says, you're my guy. You are the one. You're the guy who's going to do my demos for me. So I did all of his demos for him for probably, I don't know, 10 years, something like that. And along the way, there were several that ended up on a double album that he produced with Waylon Jennings and Mel Tillis and Bobby Bear and who was the other guy? I can't remember. But it was this double live album called Old Dogs, and I demoed all the songs on that one. And there was this one other song about being sung as if it were from a girl that it was kind of like a girl saying to her mother, hey, Mom, look at me now. I'm a star, and people all think, you know, I'm something special. And you're the one who told me I should never, ever, ever take up music as a profession. And that song ended up being the one that Shirley MacLaine sang in Postcards from the Edge as she was leaning against the piano in the long red dress with the spaghetti straps, and it won an Oscar.
And I remember that. Yeah.
It won an Oscar for the best song of the year. And I demoed that song for him. In fact, I co-wrote some of it because I ended up, but that's how we ended up working together, was if there was anything about the song that I didn't like, he trusted me to change it. And, like that one song that you've heard me do, I Just Came Down for the Weekend. All he gave me was a first verse and a chorus. And I said, where's the rest of the song? He said, I don't know. I said, why not? I mean, what happened? He said, hardening of the artistry, I guess.
And you made the rest of that song.
Yeah. And that's how we worked, you know. And it was fun. We had a great time. It was,
but you know that song is so true because that's what happens to most of us.
Well, see, that's the whole thing about songwriting that people don't realize is if you write a very, very personal song about, you know, you and yourself or a relationship or something like that, you've narrowed the scope of that song to the point where the only person that it really makes any sense to is you. Whereas if you broaden your scope and you try to write songs that have a fairly universal message to them, a universal concept, then in one way or another, almost everybody will relate to it on a personal basis.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to, you can't be, it's easier to write a song about getting lost in the forest than it is to write a song, than it is to writing a song about examining a tree.
Right.
You see the point?
Yeah, I do. I see the point. Yeah.
Yeah, because you can narrow the scope so much that it's only a personal song.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why the genius songwriters, like the James Taylors or the Jackson Browns or the people like that, can take what sounds to be a very personal event, a very private thing that's happened to them, but make it a universal concept by mm-hmm. by giving the overview, by creating the arc of the story, and so that you and I can listen to it and go, oh yeah, that's happened to me too.
And you know, we've only got about 5 minutes left in the show.
Okay.
But oh my God, I have so many more questions for you. I'm like blown away. So I'm hoping sometime in the future we maybe can do this again. I'm going to leave that up to you. I'm not going to put you on the spot on here. But I did want, again, to tell everybody, Michael can be found at Schooner Wharf almost every day of the week, every day but Monday and Tuesday.
Monday and Tuesday. Right.
Yeah, or his days off. His music, and he also sells T-shirts. You can find at MicahMcLeodMusic.com, or you can download it CDBaby.com or iTunes. And I'm going to leave the rest of the show up to you. We've got about 4 minutes. And
okay.
So, you know, I just, there's so many more questions, and if I ask you another question, it'll be way too long. So, you know, I want to hear more, though, so I would really, really like to do this again sometime. And maybe a half an hour, another hour. And,
okay.
But future CD, okay, that's a quick question. There are some songs that you know I want, and you've been working on a future CD, but you've got so much on your plate with all of your extracurricular activities. When do you think that will be out?
Well, I'm sitting here looking at your song right now on my computer, and it's real close to being finished. I'm just trying to decide which one of these guitar players I want playing the lead guitar line, and I've got six of them that I'm auditioning at the same time, you know. So, but I have to pick, you know, the one that I like best. It's you know, it's the recording process, you know. You start with the skeleton of the song, and then you add the muscles and the tendons and the cartilage, and then you put the skin on top of that, and then you put some clothes on top of the skin, and then you put a hat on top of it, and then you add the belt, and you add the corsage, and by the time you're through, you've got a song.
Right.
You know, and but each of those things has to work with every other thing that's in the song.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like building an entity. It's just like building a living thing.
Right. And so, you know, Michael, I feel blessed to have had you on the show.
Well, good.
It was an honor. Thank you so much.
Okay.
And you know, I will see you on Friday at Schooner Wharf, just as usual.
I don't doubt it. That'd be great.
And again, thank you. And I hope we can do it again sometime.
Cool. Sounds like a good idea.
Okay. Great. All right, so I'm going to play one of your songs to end the show. And
okay.
I think I'm choosing a shorter one. So just came down for the weekend. Thank you, everybody, for coming to Keeping It Real with Cindy. I always appreciate. Without you, I wouldn't have a show. Thanks. Bye-bye.
I just come down for the weekend, running from the ice and snow. Where the tropic sun come peeking across the Gulf of Mexico. The sunshine that I'd been seeking I found where the warm winds blow. Just come down for the weekend 25 years ago. Now I'm sitting in my salty jeans, eating plantains with me rice and beans, drinking rum and singing island songs. Just an old tourist who stayed too long. Be warning all your folks tonight, you can have your fun, but don't you miss your flight. If you do, then you just might turn out to be acting just like me. Well, I still got me round trip ticket. I keep it just up over my bed. Fold it to plug that hole in my roof and keep it rain off of my head. I ain't returning no phone call. I
ain't accepting no mail. Me singing and a calling out to the dolphins and a grouper and a yellow tail. So I'm sitting in my salty jeans, eating plantains and me rising beans, drinking rum and singing island songs. Just an old tourist who stayed too long. I'm warning all you folks tonight, you can have your fun, but don't you miss your flight. If you do, then you just might turn out to be acting just like me.